all this month, starting the year off, I've been talking about what I'm thinking of as the like really foundational or like building blocks of Buddhist practice, Dharma practice in a fairly traditional way, and then how that might resonate as building blocks for spiritual practice in general. So we talked about letting ethics and ethical action be the foundation of the path. We talked last week about Sangha, finding your circle, being connected with others as a foundation on the path. And I want to talk this week about another of the topics that the Buddha, when he would give what's called the gradual teaching, would always be either the first or very near the beginning of the either the first teaching or very near the beginning, which is the teaching on dana, which means giving. Dana is a word that is often translated either as giving or generosity. We think of it as generosity practice. And very often, especially in the convert Buddhisms, like insight meditation, my primary lineage, dana is often thought of in a very limited way or a very simplistic way. The most common way I hear the word used is like giving dana means the money that you give to support a class or at the end of retreat or something like that, giving to support the teachers and the institutions. And that is a very traditional way of using it. But that makes it seem, in a certain way, like dana, as in like, I give the dana talk or I'm going to give some dana to this teacher. It makes it seem like the gift itself is called dana. But dana is one of the perfections. It's one of the paramis. And it's the first of them. And it's the first in many of the lists that it appears in. And it's not actually the thing itself. It's not a gift. Dana is giving as a practice. And the practice of dana is taught again and again in the early texts as being foundational to the entire path. And I want to unpack it a little bit here in that way. Why would giving be the first practice, essentially? We can think about it a few ways. One is that Buddhism began as a community of folks who were invited to leave household life, which also meant leaving the kind of commercial economy, the family economy, and rely entirely on the gifts of others to go begging for alms, food, clothing, shelter, requisites, like medicine. And to own nothing, to not grow their own food. There's a whole set of structures around the early Sangha that demanded that they live based on the generosity of others. So then the Buddha teaches giving as the first practice. First of all, how could any monastic practice if giving didn't already exist in the culture? You can't leave the home life and become homeless if there is no giving structure in your community. Right? You would last 2 weeks. So giving, in a certain way, and it's interesting, giving has to be a quality held by the larger community, even a community that doesn't have faith yet. It has to be a cultural value, or else it's impossible to live off of it. Right? If the early monastics had to only accept alms from people who already totally believed the Buddha's teachings, there's a sort of chicken and egg thing that where it would be very difficult to grow, as a community. You have to actually, receive gifts from others for this thing to thrive at all, for the Buddha himself to practice and to go on. And in a certain way, we can think about the Buddha's own life as the source of this, the importance of this thing. So as many of you know, in the Buddha's story, he starts off wealthy. He gives up his wealth when he realizes that he's going to die and lose it all anyway, and that he was totally unprepared for that. And he heard that these folks living out in the woods living on alms, we're seeking the deathless, seeking that which is free from this fear of death and loss and trauma. And he goes to do that. And he goes to do it partly because he sees one of them. He sees a monastic walking through town of a different sect, of course, because he hadn't made his yet. And he says, wait, you know, what's that person doing? And so he goes off and he studies with two different yoga teachers, Uddaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, and he learns their practices. So he's already embedded in generosity structures, right? He learns that from his culture. It's already around. And then he goes off to do ascetic practice and does not receive alms. He does this kind of starvation practice where he eats, you know, less and less and less and less until he's eating, you know, one kola fruit a day and one kola fruit a week. And in the passage that describes it, it says, he's teaching later on, he's telling his story, and he says, and you may think, monks, that once upon a time, way back then, a kola fruit was bigger than it is now, but it was not. In fact, it was about the same size as it is now. And you're like, oh, he's like joshing with them. He's like joking with them, you know. Like, it's funny. It must have been funny then as it is funny now. So he lives eventually on nothing. He says eventually he lives on, you know, whatever happened to blow into his lap while he was sitting there. And he almost dies because, of course, you can't live on that. And in almost dying, he realizes that there has to be another way. He remembers his childhood experience of meditative concentration. He realizes he needs to be healthy in order to be happy enough to meditate in that way. And then he takes a gift of milk rice from a woman named Sujata. And often the part of the story that's emphasized is his changing his mind about asceticism. He says, oh, rather than starving the body, mortifying the body, I will nourish the body, and then I'll be able to practice in this concentrated way. And that's important, right? Because that's what is the basis of him enunciating the middle way, the way that avoids the extremes of self-mortification and indulgence, which is the wealth that he grew up in. So he finds that middle way. But it's less emphasized that, of course, to do that, he has to accept a gift first. And there's a story in the commentaries about Sujata, who gives the first gift. She was a wealthy woman in town. And she had been praying for a child and had not been able to conceive, and finally goes out at one point to the forest as one might in this situation at that time and place, and she makes an offering to an important tree spirit. She goes to the forest and prays to the earth and says, may I have a child? At this huge tree, she leaves offerings. She goes back to her life. She becomes pregnant. She has a child, a son named Yasa. And after a year, wants to make an offering to this tree spirit in gratitude for her wish being granted. And the commentary says that she milked 1,000 of her best cows and then fed that milk to 100 cows and then milked them, and fed that milk to 10 cows and milked them, and then fed that milk to one cow and milked it. And there's this sense that, like, somehow in this ritual reduction process, she's getting this substance that is, like, really good stuff, like the most amazing, rich substance. And then she makes milk rice with it, and she takes it ceremonially out to the forest to give it to this tree. And when she gets out there, she sees, sitting at the foot of the tree, a being who looks barely human, an ancient-looking man who's deep in himself, his eyes like sockets that you could see in, almost no skin and bones on him, barely there. And she says to herself, this must be the tree spirit. And she brings the rice to offer it. And the karma of the Dhamma coming into the world is that it coincides, her gift, with his realization that he must accept a gift in order to live and practice. And those two things come together. She realizes that it's a human, not the tree spirit. And she says, well, it's auspicious to give food like this to a noble ascetic seeking the deathless. She gives it to him. She becomes the first lay follower, the very first disciple. And he takes the food, and the story goes on. Enlightenment, teaching, yada, yada. Eventually her son Yasa becomes a kind of teenage playboy and then eventually finds the Buddha and becomes a monk, becomes fully enlightened. So what if this story hints to the Buddha-to-be at the impossibility in a certain way of going it alone and the necessity to receive support? And then he comes out and says, oh, the way that you practice, actually, is to let go of self-reliance in the economy. You let go of, like, earning your money and caring for your family, and in a certain way, being, having the privilege to remain separate. And this is one of the most painful karmas of being wealthy, is that it makes it possible to not connect with others. I remember being in Luang Prabang in Laos, which is an incredible city. It's gotten a little touristy now. It's the old capital. And we did a loop that is quite popular, but from Chiang Mai, northern Thailand, overland to the river, to the upper Mekong River, and then down on a boat to Luang Prabang, which is stunning. We were there over New Year's, the year we were there. And so I'm walking through the streets, and I'm walking down the street, and on one side of the street is an old colonial, essentially, palace. It's this big, wide thing with, like, big mahogany pillars and a gorgeous green lawn. It's, like, pristine and, like, marble walkways. It's just a stunning-looking thing behind a little wall. Totally empty. I can't see a soul in there. It's just, it looks perfect. There's nobody there. Directly across the street is a street market where there's people selling everything, and they're out on the sidewalk, and everybody is over there. So hundreds and hundreds of people milling around this street market, all mashed up together. And of course, mostly poor people. And then across the street is this kind of pristine resort. Nobody's there. And we really got the hit. My brilliant partner, Sarah, said at that moment, she looked at that, and she looked at that, and she said, in this moment, if these were your two options, would you rather be rich or poor? And I'm like, I mean, I know I'm kind of an introvert, but I'm going to go over there because the food's there, the mood, music is there, the people are there. Right? So there is this karma that perhaps in a certain way the Buddha was figuring out how to overcome, something about how he grew up wealthy. Right? The stories of him growing up in wealth are weirdly, they're kind of creepy. And they got hyper mythologized, so they got creepier as the myths went on. But eventually the story is like he had three palaces for each of the three seasons, which really means like climate control, right? He's just comfortable all the time, right? This one's cool, this one's warm, this one's dry, anytime flowers wilted in the palace, at night they were secretly removed and replaced with fresh ones. And if any of the servants and the musician women, and the musicians were all women, if you're rich at that time, I don't know what, it's very nice, if you like women musicians, anytime they aged a little bit or got pregnant or got sick or anything, they were replaced by fresh young women playing music. Creepy, right? It starts to get like, oh, and even, and this one's super creepy, relationally, even his friends as kids would kind of disappear if they got hurt or older or somehow weren't fresh anymore. And it's like, ew. Yeah. That's just not real in a certain way. And so like, oh, he comes out of this incredible wealth. And then, you know, his great vision is you can't do it alone. You have to take help. It's better to live communally in the forest than, you know, in palaces with your weird dad who would never let you go out. And the most important practice is giving. So there's one seed, perhaps, of it in his own life. And then the necessity of giving to support the monastic community. as the teaching on giving goes on in the texts, as it's discussed as the action component of one of the core intentions in practice, which is the intention toward renunciation. And renunciation is the training in letting go. And letting go is the thing that defeats craving or clinging, which is the cause of suffering. Mm-hmm. So here's the sequence. Learn to give. Learn how to let go. Let go of everything, and you're free. And that through line then goes through the entire Dhamma, the entire sequence of the teachings. So dana is this word that literally translates as giving. The word for generosity is different. The word is kaga. And it speaks specifically to kind of the giving of gifts, the one who gives gifts. And the practice of dana, of giving, is the practice of cultivating this quality of generosity. Right, kaga, the quality of, the old translation would be like munificence, you know, the one who gives bountiful gifts. And there are teachings that the Buddha gives to wealthy lay people and to royals that essentially are, give your wealth away. When he teaches in the Sigalaka Sutta how to worship the six directions, he meets this young man who was told by his elders to worship the directions. So he's dutifully out there at dawn pouring water in the directions. And the Buddha comes up, and this might be a little jab at his competitors over in the, you know, Vedantic side of things. He says, "Oh, young man, you're doing it wrong. You're not worshiping the directions correctly." And the guy's like, "Oh, well, schooled by an elder, tell me how to do it." And the Buddha says, "This direction is your parents. This direction is your teachers. This direction is your servants. This direction is your friends. This direction..." And he actually says, to worship the directions is not to stand out here and offer water in the compass directions. To worship the directions is actually to pay homage to and support to the community. It's people that are around you. And so he teaches him how to honor his parents and take care of them, and how to take care of his servants, the people that work for him. How to support ascetics and practitioners and elders in that way, how to care for children. And in this sense, giving becomes not an abstraction or an internal practice, like, "Oh, I'm just cultivating generosity, you know, in myself." But as a quality, it really is it's specifically an action, like just give away wealth. And again, it's not random that the Buddha comes from wealth, and he really bases this layer of the teachings on an understanding of what to do with material resources, as they should be given away. In a different text, a king is having trouble with crime in his kingdom. And the Buddha says, "Oh, king, you're having trouble with crime. People are, you know, bandits are stealing people and murdering people. And you want to bring in the army and, you know, stop the crime." He said, "That's not the way to do it. Here's the way. Assemble your resources." In other words, tax people with money. Assemble your resources from the wealthy all around your land. And to everyone running businesses, give them capital. Like, give money to business people. To everyone who doesn't have businesses and is living off the land, the farmers, give them seed, give them tools to farm. People who are poor, give them food, give them housing. Basically, figure out what everyone needs to fulfill their social place and support that by distributing resources. And this is what the wheel-turning king does. The king that governs righteously. And so we are asked then to begin our practice, in a sense to come into faith in the Dhamma by, and in a certain way, this is a corollary to what we talked about last week with, like, find your circle, you know, enter the Sangha. The thing to do is to enter the circle of people by giving to them. And if you are one who doesn't have resources to give, like you're an ascetic practicing in poverty, or you're one who is poor, who is of a non-resource-rich social class, then you receive gifts in order to do your work. And then you give what you can. So the ascetic who receives material gifts gives back in the form of teachings and counseling and guidance and teaching and maintaining the lineage, etc. As a side note, I'll say that this model, which is a beautiful model of a very not capitalist social structure, it, I think, is beautiful and depends on social stability to work. In other words, if you believe that every poor person can uplift themselves by working really hard and eventually become rich, this structure starts to falter because the king can't give enough to everybody for them to be wealthy. The king gives to people so that they can continue to do their thing. So you support the farmers to farm, you support the business people to become business people. You're not supporting all the farmers to become business people. So you're not supporting people with resources at a level that allows them to class shift. That is unsustainable because, of course, there is some impulse to accumulate. Capital likes to accumulate, so it grows and grows. So that doesn't work, right? In a certain way, I want to spin this as, you know, aspirational capitalism is fundamentally unsustainable because there's just not enough resources for everyone to keep growing or for every culture to keep growing. And so then giving becomes renunciation when those with wealth realize that they have enough and stop accumulating and start distributing instead. And so then that is the foundation of the path for everyone who begins practice as a layperson. And in a certain way, what if the path is to start giving until you really feel the spirit of renunciation and you enjoy living with less for yourself and giving to others, that becomes emotional and energetic, not just material. And at a certain point, when you are finished with your responsibilities as a layperson, like you've raised your kids, whatever you've done, or not, you know, you've supported your servants and your parents, etc., then you can go and become a monastic. Or you can retire in a very simple way, resting into having done your practice, essentially. Having not clung to anything. And how beautiful it could be if we could learn that practice of not clinging by giving in the material realm, and that if we could learn it emotionally and psychically, such that we could then stop hoarding even on the emotional or psychological, and at a certain point the whole path becomes let go of everything. Don't even cling in a certain way to this life. So thoughts and feelings on this. This is not the most taught on topic in Western Dharma, I think, because if I really take it seriously, it really makes it difficult to continue to conform to our capitalist system. And Western Dharma is not willing yet to become economically radical, I think. So then we skate over this teaching because it doesn't fit very well. You know, at the Thai temple where we did retreats with Christopher Titmus, my teacher, bunch of hippies every year, 35 years, long tradition, Christopher would say to us, he would say, you guys, you know, it's a bunch of Europeans and Americans, mostly Europeans, practicing there. He said, you know that they work really hard to host us, and you guys give less donations than anyone who ever comes here all year. He said, one busload of Thai tourists gives more than we've given in 30 years here. On one visit. He said it's common for the Thai folks who come to this temple in Bodh Gaya on pilgrimage to give 20% of their annual income. Right? And he's like, you guys are going to give a couple hundred dollars and that's fine because it's what you have, but I want you to realize that you're being given everything by this culture and these people. And be really respectful. So we don't know how to teach on this here. And mostly, I think, most of us, myself included, were never really taught either how to give or how to receive. Mm-hmm. So, wow. So thoughts and feelings here.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Given that you're the one whose life, I'm just curious what that's been like for you and what insights you built from living from this lifestyle.
Sure. Well, I'm not living on Dana. I never have fully done so, other than when I was in Burma as a monk, actually. So I try to... here's the short version of a very complicated answer, which is that the Insight Meditation lineage, as one example, has been trying to figure this out for its entire existence. So, you know, we started coming out of the Burmese and Thai traditions that were monastic. Everything was given. You know, many of my teachers studied, you know, in lineages like the Goenka lineage, where the retreats are completely free and it, you know, pristine Dana system. And Goenka was a wealthy businessman who has quite wealthy contacts in India and South Asia. In other words, the white hippies who are doing retreat for free in Norfolk are being supported by wealthy Indian resources, right? Take that, colonialism, or something, right? So that's complex in all sorts of ways. Nothing is free. Buildings are not free. Heat is not free. Food is not free. So it has to come from somewhere. So then the Insight Meditation community has been struggling with this. Like, how do we do it? The teachers initially really wanting to give everything freely, you know, on Dana as much as possible, but they're not monastics. And so, like, they're paying rent in Fairfax. They're sending their kids to a decent school in Marin. You can't live on Dana and do that. So within the Insight Meditation teaching community, there's a few people that live fully on Dana. They're all struggling. They have all struggled the whole time to do so. The ones who do the best at it don't have children. The best solution that I've found is to divide one's economic life and have a good day job. Therapist seems to be the standard maneuver, at least in my crew. And then you get to offer, you know, the teachings that you received on Dana, on a Dana basis, and make your functional money elsewhere. That's more or less my solution right now. So, like, I don't really make anything that I could rely on from this or anything that I do on Dana, but I have other things that I've lined up to support that. You know, you can support monastics on Dana because they have three outfits and they eat once a day and they don't complain if you don't show up to feed them. Although if that persists, they will leave, you know, and try to find someone who can. But, like, the system doesn't work to support people on Dana if those people have fairly high expenses, as we do. So mostly I'll say it's difficult. And, you know, teachers have come up with all sorts of different solutions. You know, one solution is just to give in to the cultural model and charge good money for things, you know, and then have a few things that you do for less, like have a sliding scale or have a few donation-based spots or whatever. It's challenging, and huge conversations, like, up at Spirit Rock about this, you know. Some teachers pushing for, like, you know, like, things should cost and have a fair price in this economy because I'm a layperson, and other teachers being like, I really want to offer it. But you can't have a teachers collective with 25 people where 10 of them are offering the day long at $50 or free, and the other 10 are offering it at $400. So, like, what do you do? So then the institution tries to figure it out. So no great solution here.
I guess what I'm curious of is what you've learned, that they're separate and that you have, like, stability during the day, but what has it been like to actually, like, on some level pull yourself out of that conditioning of expectations of, you know, this is, you know, I got this much this week and that much next week.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder what it's like to
pull from that attachment. I have significant economic privilege in this culture, such that, like, if I need to get a job, I can just get one. Mm-hmm. And so like, oh, when I got a day job that was good enough to support me and I didn't have to count heads in my class, I felt like a weight drop off my heart. Because going to teach class and being, you know, I'm teaching yoga, let's say. I'm teaching asana, people are doing their thing, I'm laying out teachings, everything is all sort of lovely in the kind of diluted, you know, Western yoga studio sort of way. But in my head, I'm like, what did they go? 12 people, 12 times 4 is 48. $4 a head, $48 for teaching this hour and a half class, minus 15% for self-employment taxes, because we're all that, plus travel time, and I'm making $8 an hour. Like, okay, you know, 30 maybe, but, you know, for the entire thing, but how many of those can you do a week? You know, I couldn't teach more than 6 classes a week, or else I would just start to hate yoga. So then, you know, right?
Yeah.
So I'm making, you know, you can't live on that. You know, I could never live on that. A monastic could live on that, embedded in the communal structure. So I had to get out of that. So I did it by not making it matter in a certain way, and making the teaching as this is essentially a gift. Mm. You know, it's important that this class is supported by resources coming in. It would be hard for me to maintain it fully as a gift, like to not make anything ever. And the studio wouldn't let us do that. But if they didn't make anything at all, they would let me do it, but you know, hashtag labor rights. But they wouldn't do it. So it has to bring in something for the system to function and for it to psychically function, right? Like emotionally, I'm not liberated enough to be able to teach absolutely for free forever. I would start to get confused, right, at a certain point. Unless, and I wonder about this, like, at what point would material support hit a threshold where I could actually completely give without a twinge in the heart? And it's like, oh, they work together in a certain way. If I'm struggling for in a kind of scarcity model, if I don't have enough to live on, it's very difficult to live, to teach in this like fully generous way. And so I can feel basically the relationship between material stability, nervous system ease, and the ability to be generous. You know? And so I was reflecting with a friend today. I was like, what if the Buddha taught letting go because he was wealthy and that's the right medicine for the wealthy? Jesus was poor, so he didn't teach letting go. He taught uplifting the poor. What if these different sort of lineages arose within their economic conditions as the right medicine for the people who invented them? Like the Buddha figured out, this is how to get free from wealth.
Yeah.
And Jesus was like, this is how to get free from poverty. Right? The poor need to be uplifted. The wealthy need to let go. And that becomes the Dharma in a way that they teach, you know, that that resonates kind of from that exact place. So to the extent that the more that I feel comfortable in wealth, like, the more I can offer, you know. And comfortable in wealth doesn't mean me being wealthy, but like, when I was a monastic, it was so easy in a way. Like, wow. You can go there, take on their system, like, basically, don't break the rules, and they will feed you and clothe you forever. Like, you can be done from the economy forever, if you choose. And, you know, the price is not much, you know? The giving up sex part is the main thing that gets people, you know, and then physical comfort, you know? The worst thing for me there was it was only a cold water shower. And I'm just a hot water kind of body. And so every single day, I was just like, okay, you know, let go of that preference. But like, you know, not bad. And there were moments when I was like, I don't ever have to work again if I don't want. And that's been a really deep karma for me. I had that first hit when I very first lived at a monastery, my first Zen center, Bodhimunda in New Mexico. I was 25. Super, super lost and confused. But I landed there, and their policy at the time was, you know, you pay the guest fee for 3 months. And it was $300 a month to practice there. And once you're there for 3 months and you've paid that, they just make you staff. And then you never pay again if you don't want to. And I lasted that 3 months, which is to say I gave them my last $900. And I just stayed. And no one ever asked me for another thing. And at a certain point, I was like, I could feel that I had been scared for a decade or more since I realized what economics meant, what it would mean as an adult. I was scared of failing in the economy and ending up just kind of destitute. And I didn't even know I was scared of it, you know, until someone suggested that I didn't have to fear that, that there was this place that would catch me, and that I didn't have to earn it. And that was incredible. That was like, I didn't even know I was terrified until that terror slipped away a little bit. So there's something about that. So may our culture mature to the point where giving is a natural impulse of adults. And the structures that divide people from each other based in greed just fall away as unnecessary. May we be a culture that gives to everyone who needs it. So, thanks for being here. Good to see you. We'll continue. Next Tuesday I will be here. It will be my birthday. So we'll have a special birthday teaching, whatever it is.